I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Federal drug regulators are deciding what to do about two popular pain relievers now that the second, naproxen, commonly known as Aleve, has been shown to increase the risk of heart attacks and stroke. Last week, questions were raised about the popular painkiller Celebrex. Now the National Institutes of Health have suspended an Alzheimer's prevention study that used both Aleve and Celebrex because of concerns of the drug's possible role in heart disease. Joining us on the line is Dr. Robert Green, a neurologist at Boston University. He was involved in the just halted study. And Dr. Green, that study was funded by the NIH. What went wrong?
Well, Robin, two things happened last week. One, the new data on Celebrex came out from Pfizer and raised concerns about the safety of Celebrex, which, you know, was not entirely unexpected given the COX-2 inhibitors, Vioxx and so forth, the story that had been developing.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that happened was that every major study monitors its own safety very carefully. And our monitoring group looked at our data and found that in the preliminary analysis, the people who were on naproxen appeared to have more heart disease and heart attacks than the people who were not, who were on placebo.
In fact, 50% more.
That's right.
Well, but the interesting thing, even though this study appeared to show this increase in heart problems, 50% increase with those using Aleve, it didn't show the same thing with Celebrex.
That's right. And it just goes to show that different studies are giving people different results. So I think everybody should take this with a grain of salt at the moment until the findings are verified, until they're reanalyzed and looked at carefully. This has all happened very, very fast.
Well, take it with a grain of salt, but do you take it with your Aleve? As you know, as you well know, Doctor, many people last week switched from Celebrex to Aleve.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, Aleve has been called into question. And it's been in use since 1976, yet this is the first study that shows there might be some problems. Doctor, what does this say about the way the U.S. is controlling drugs?
I do think there are issues with the system at large. In this particular instance, I think the clinical trial system and the safety monitoring has worked quite well.
This system, but some might ask, if this drug has been out since 1976, why wasn't it tested for possible heart problems prior to a test on Alzheimer's?
I think the system itself, as you well know, rewards short-term trials and very rarely allows the testing of long-term exposures of drugs
mm-hmm.
For long-term side effects. That seems to be a flaw that's built in at the present time, and there are no incentives for manufacturers to do this.
What would you suggest that people in pain do? For instance, does this new news about Aleve trump the benefits of Aleve? If you're taking it, for instance, to relieve pain so that you can move about, maybe work out, to benefit your heart, what should you do? Should you stop taking it?
I think people who need to be on these medications should not stop taking it. I think what we have ended up hearing here is the first wave of a possible note of caution. And you're absolutely right. People have been taking naproxen for decades, and it's not clear at all that it's unsafe to take it. It certainly is not clear at all that it's unsafe to take it for short periods of time. Also, remember that in these particular studies, these are individuals over 70 in our study who were first-degree relatives of Alzheimer patients who were taking this as a possible way of preventing or slowing the onset of Alzheimer's disease. So they're not the general population at all.
So, in fact, they might be older. And answer this quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Why would a pain reliever relieve Alzheimer's?
There are a number of epidemiologic studies that have suggested that anti-inflammatories might have a role in slowing or preventing Alzheimer's. And that's what this study was designed to test. Now, at this point, we've suspended the drug and suspended the treatment in the study, but we'll still be following these individuals to see if the exposure does, in fact, keep some of them from developing Alzheimer's disease. So the study will continue, even if the drug use is suspended.
In the meantime, Doctor, what are doctors at the FDA recommending for patients who want to continue taking Aleve?
I believe what they're recommending is that people take them freely for up to 10 days and that they consult their doctor if they're going to be taking them for longer periods of time. In our particular study, people were on these medications for years, and that may be part of why this potential safety problem is emerging.
And additional instructions are to take them at the labeled instructions, which I believe are 440 milligrams a day.
Right.
Dr. Robert Green, a neurologist at Boston University, involved in the National Institutes of Health Alzheimer's study that was halted because of concerns that one of the drugs involved, Aleve, might actually increase heart disease. Doctor, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
there's been a small triumph in the book world, a novel just released has quickly become one of the only 5 books on the New York Times list of best fiction of 2004. And readers can be forgiven for thinking the title of the book is Marilynne Robinson's long-awaited second novel, Gilead. Gilead comes 23 years after the author's first jewel of a book, Housekeeping. It tells the story of a 74-year-old preacher, John Ames, living a life of holy poverty in Gilead, Iowa in 1956, unexpectedly blessed with a 6-year-old son and marriage to a much younger woman, just as his own life is ending. The book takes the form of a letter to the Reverend's young son, telling him of the 100 years of the family's preachers, stretching back to the grandfather who conspired with, perhaps murdered with, abolitionist John Brown. John Ames eyes the world with wonder to the last minute of his life. As he says, this is an interesting planet. It deserves all the attention you can give it. His creator, author Marilynne Robinson, joins us now. And Marilynne, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, you all right? With all the bouquets being thrown at you by critics this past month, I fear for your health.
I'm surviving so far.
I would hope so. And congratulations on the book and the way it's being received. And tell us, who is Reverend John Ames? How did he come to you?
Well, you know, I try to explain this to people, and it sounds like a kind of mysticism or something, but when I write novels, now that I have 2, I can say novels, I'm dependent on having the sense of the voice that would be the teller of the story. And these voices simply sort of, something suggests them to me, or they put themselves together out of odd bits. I don't know how it happens, but in any case, at a certain point, I had the conception of this man. He grew out of a minor character in another piece of fiction I was working on that I didn't like. He resembles the original character very little, except that they're both ministers. Mm-hmm. But it simply happened at a certain point that I knew this voice and knew a great deal about him. I had been reading History of the Settlement of the Middle West for a long time. It's a very interesting history. And a great deal that is present in that novel came from that.
Well, in fact, we do learn or are reminded about that. In telling John Ames' story, we're reminded of the abolitionist movement, the Free Soilers in Kansas, and the role of small towns across the Midwest, which I think you're referring to, acting as a bulwark against slavery. Tell us about that.
Well, there was a large movement in the early half of the 19th century of people who were opposed to slavery moving out into the Middle West, because if the constitutions that were passed in those territories as they became states permitted slavery, then the whole balance that had contained it up to that point in any degree would have been lost. And also they knew from the experience of the War of 1812 that if anyone controlled the interior of the country, the Middle West, they had more or less a free hand with the rest of it, you know. So from the point of view of political strategy, and even I think in anticipation of perhaps a sectional war, they moved in very large numbers into the Middle West and set up these little towns.
Well, and your character, John Ames, is telling his young son the story of his grandfather, John Ames' grandfather, who had a vision. He had several visions, actually. God spoke to him in the parlor. But the first vision inspired him to move from Maine to Kansas and then to Iowa with his family. And the vision told him to fight slavery and fight alongside John Brown?
Well, you know, John Brown had many contemporaries like Quantrill and the James brothers and so on, who were vastly more violent than he was and on the side of slavery. And, of course, John Brown was a religious visionary. He did things in the name of God, but so did they, you know. Mm. I mean, it's not as if even religious fanaticism were on one side of the issue. I myself think that John Brown has been villainized inappropriately because, slavery was horrible. And I'm not shocked particularly that somebody would be driven a little over the edge by the hatred of it. I think it's much more shocking that so many people did so much violence in defense of it.
Yeah. What are you saying in the book about faith-based activism? Because this fierce grandfather begats a son, another preacher, who despises his father's activism and becomes a pacifist.
Yes. Well, he hated the war.
The Civil War.
And war is hateful, you know. I mean, I suppose that I have not put my characters in the position of solving a moral dilemma that I myself cannot solve. I think it's a very real question. I think if ever a war was justified, perhaps the Civil War was justified from the point of view of the North. And I think it's important to remember that what set it off was, in the first place, the lawful election of Abraham Lincoln, and in the second place, the firing on Fort Sumter, which was a Southern choice. So there's no question that the slave system was penetrating the whole country, and that if anything meaningful was to be salvaged out of American experience to that point, slavery had to be ended. But on the other hand, it was a terrible war and a horrible loss to the country and a shame and a disaster. Both of these things are true at the same time.
Right. And your character, again, John Ames, at 74, is contemplating all of this as he looks towards the end of his life and tries to leave something for his son to read, and as he also contemplates the modern world. I mean, I'm thinking of images in 1956, light reflecting off a sprinkler that his son is jumping through. A lot of readers of Gilead are going to, of a certain age, are going to be reminded of their own grandparents in the 50s and maybe what their internal lives were like. And I found myself reading and thinking, gee, I forgot how far back their lives extended.
Yes, my own grandfather used to talk about his boyhood on the Great Plains. It was amazing. I mean, it just seemed as if it had been hundreds of years before.
And even though in reflecting on those 100 years, John Ames talks about the Depression, as you said, about the outcome of the effects of the Civil War, the loss of his first wife and child 50 years before the narrative takes place, he still shimmers with hope. Marilynne Robinson, we're going to take a break, but just before we go, leave us with how would you characterize John Ames' vision of the world?
Well, he's a very religious man. He sees the world as being essentially, one might say, improbable, having a sort of intrinsic miraculous character in every aspect. And so, as he says, you know, he imagines something yet more miraculous succeeding it, or something that will comprehend all of this beauty in a larger system of beauty. It's a theological hope that he has, you know.
Author Marilynne Robinson, her new book, Gilead, is getting rave reviews. Stay there, because when we come back, we're going to ask Marilynne, why did she take 23 years between novels? And what does she teach students at the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop who want to be just like her? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation with author Marilynne Robinson, who's just released her second novel, the highly acclaimed Gilead. It's about a 70-something Iowa preacher, his letter to his young son attempting to tell the boy, before the Reverend dies, about generations of family preachers and what they stood for. And Marilynne Robinson, as steeped as you are in religion, you've also said that you've spent your life watching not to see beyond this world, but that which is plainly before your eyes, including, you've also said, how generations forget what previous generations learned.
Also, what people put on the landscape. I mean, in a way, buildings and towns and so on are sort of expressions of significance or event.
Well, and I'm thinking of those sorts of things, not just landscape, you know, the prairie, which Reverend Ames, your character, just resonates for him. But I'm thinking of the small observations in Gilead, children who baptize part of a litter of cats, and then they're worried which ones they've missed and have consigned to a life of paganism. Here's a line, grasshoppers that fly up from a dusty Kansas road, making that little snap they make like the striking of a match. Do you gather these as you, you know, observe the world around you and then find a place in the novel where they fit?
Well, when I look at, one of the questions that I'm very much in the habit of asking myself is, what is it like? You know what I mean? If I notice that something's striking to me, I try to sort of capture it in association, in a way, consciously, you know. But it's interesting to me the degree to which the writing of anything to me is secondary to a certain kind of experience. First of all, I see the world, and then it's interesting to me to make a record of the fact. But nothing I do is in order to write.
Apparently not, because, you've been told so often, this is, 21 years, that people have been waiting for your second book. Did you feel any rush to bring another one out?
I didn't really. I'm happy to have written another book. I take a good deal of satisfaction from the fact that housekeeping is not an only child anymore. But on the other hand, I live in order to live and write as an expression of experience. I would hate the idea of writing a book I didn't really feel.
Hmm. How did you prepare for this book? Because you make references throughout to, well, here's some of them, Jean-Paul Sartre, bean salads, which look distinctly Presbyterian, Calvin, Karl Barth, the diary of a country priest. Your character reads volumes. Did you as well?
Oh, yes, I read a lot, and I've read a great deal of theology, because good theology is very beautiful. It's like epic poetry or something. It's just very beautiful. So I've read a lot, Karl Barth especially.
And looking for what?
Oh, the kind of resonance that you feel in great poetry, really. I mean, something that generates and confirms itself as a beautiful model of reality.
Yeah. You also are teaching writing. What do you tell those who come looking to do the next housekeeping or now the next Gilead, looking to write?
What I do basically is try to tell them that what they should do is write the book or the fiction that they want to read. I think anybody who wants to write feels that there is some vision or sense of things that is not present, not represented in the world. And that's their testimony. That's the thing that they that they should do to help them find and value their individuality is probably the first thing to do.
And what can we know about you in the few minutes we have left? Who are you? Where'd you come from?
One of those great mysteries, isn't it? Well, I grew up in Idaho. I went to college at Brown. I went to graduate school at the University of Washington. I have two children, two sons who are both grown men. I've lived in Iowa for about 15 years.
And I'm thinking one of your close friends from my reading is author Frank Conroy.
Yes.
Who has written somewhat, autobiographically about himself through his fiction, Prince of Tides and others. What do we see of you in Gilead?
One thing that you see is the landscape that I've been looking at for 15 years. That's certainly true. When I first came to the Middle West, I felt as if I had to learn how to see it, because it was not like any landscape I'd ever lived in before. People tend to think of biography as event, but for a lot of people, I think biography is perception and thought, at least very, very largely. I think part of the reason John Ames is the kind of character he is, insofar as he's expressing, me, is that I like the idea that how people think is an enormously large constituent of many people's lives, which tends to be slighted. When you have a life like his that occurred in a very small compass, was it a large life or a small life? I think that if you only knew biographical facts about him, you'd say very small. But I think if you know where his thoughts have been, you'd say very large.
Where does Reverend Ames get his wonder? Again, 74 years old. You would think someone who just is leaving the world just as it's given him such a gift, this beautiful son that he adores and a young wife, and you would think there'd be some cynicism there. And I can't find one word.
Well, he has a metaphysical perception. The beauty of everything, even the beauty of what he has to lose twice in his life. He feeds off the beauty of even tragic relationships as part of this sort of basic energy of reality itself.
He says at one point, one of my favorite lines, "I have been thinking lately how much I have loved my physical life."
Mm-hmm.
Marilyn Robinson, thank you so much for Gilead and for talking to us about it.
Pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Marilynne Robinson, the author of Gilead, a novel that chronicles generations of preachers through letters from an elderly father to his young son. Here is a reading of one of those letters.
There was more to it, of course. For me, writing has always felt like praying, even when I wasn't writing prayers, as I was often enough. You feel that you are with someone. I feel I'm with you now, whatever that can mean. Considering that you're only a little fellow now, and when you're a man, you might find these letters of no interest. Or they might never reach you for any of a number of reasons. Well, but how deeply I regret any sadness you have suffered, and how grateful I am in anticipation of any good you have enjoyed. That is to say, I pray for you, and there's an intimacy in it. That's the truth.
A reading from Marilynne Robinson's new novel, Gilead. Stay with us, there's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and as you may have just heard, insurgents in the Iraqi city of Mosul have struck a U.S. base there. We'll have more in a moment. But first, many American veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will be spending the upcoming Christmas holiday in VA hospitals across the country. Here now, Fred Tice visited one in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, where he met Sergeant James Latham from Omaha, Nebraska, currently the only Iraq veteran on the hospital's spinal cord injury ward.
Compared to other wars, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, not that many veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan have been hospitalized with spinal injuries at West Roxbury because of budget constraints and because it's hard for the Veterans Administration to match the pay of other hospitals in Boston. There are only so many nurses on the ward, and thus only so many patients can be admitted. In recent days, there's been a rush to get the soldiers home if they can go home, and sometime this week, Sergeant Latham hopes to be the last of the Iraq veterans of the ward to head home for the holidays. He's been here for 4 months.
Well, I was stationed at the Baghdad International Airport, and one day I was walking back from lunch, and I got hit by some shrapnel from a rocket attack.
It was the 4th of July.
It hit me in my spine, and I am paralyzed anywhere under that point.
He moves his wheelchair by puffing on a straw. Latham spent 2 months at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, then transferred to West Roxbury.
We got up here on August 17th.
Latham's wife, Amy, has been in Boston with him since August.
I mean, it was hard when it first happened, learning that he was paralyzed from the neck down. And the doctors don't like to give words of encouragement too often because they don't want you to sit there and hope for things that may not happen, but we're pretty hopeful that he will get all of his functions back because his spine was not cut or severed or scratched or anything like that. And, I mean, he's made so much progress just since July 4th. He couldn't talk at all. He only started speaking at the end of August. And, I mean, just he's come so far. They say it'll be about a year to 2 years before he'll see his full potential. But they did say that in about 6 months, he will get off the ventilator and the trach, and that's what we're looking forward to.
Whether patients with spinal cord injury walk again depends a great deal on whether they can recover some sensation after a few days. Dr. Sunil Sabharwal, chief of spinal cord injury at West Roxbury, says patients who have no feeling after several days have a 5% chance of walking again.
people hope, and I think one of the really fine lines that professionals who are dealing with someone with spinal cord injury is to try and separate the hope from the hype. You don't want to take someone's hope away. And truly, the science has not developed, at least at this point, to the extent where you can say for sure to someone that, no, you will not be able to walk.
The physical blow of paralysis and the work of rehabilitation is just the first hurdle for veterans who have lost the use of their limbs. There's also a huge financial cost. The military takes care of the hospitalization, but that's just the beginning.
We've been living in a hotel.
Amy Latham is in Boston with their 4-year-old son.
Pretty much about 3 o'clock, I go get our son from school. I go back to the hotel, fix dinner, bring it back here, have a meet. We watch a movie, and then I go home for the evening.
The Army will reimburse Latham for the hotel and meals, but in the meantime, she's out about $10,000. And then there's the cost of renting a car and putting their son through preschool in Boston. A patchwork of philanthropies helps the families of wounded veterans bear the huge cost of being near their loved ones. Philanthropist Elizabeth Weber heard of the Latham story, and she's helping them pay for school and the car.
They needed a rental car. They also needed some tuition for their son that's here. And so we were able to give them a grant for, $6,000 in September to be able to help them with those expenses.
Since last year, Weber has spent $100,000 helping veterans.
People with handicap accessible ramps that needed help, babysitting, fixing their cars, snow plowing, any type of help that they may need. A lot of them can't afford simple things, and we can really make a difference doing that.
After Latham was injured, the family had to move.
We were stationed in Germany, so we had to go through the hassles of having someone send our car to Omaha, having someone send our car from Maryland, where it just got into port, all the way to Omaha, so I don't have to, fly into Maryland and pick up the car myself. And I just recently got our pet back about a couple weeks ago.
That's where Joe Badzmarowski came in.
And I received a call on my cell phone from a family member who was really hurting and was really emotionally upset because she was unable to get her cat from Germany.
The family member was Amy Latham.
Everything that they owned, for the most part, was still in Germany, and this individual was really, really hurting.
Joe Bads, to the hospital workers and patients who know him well, Badzmarowski is a senior benefits advocate in Boston for the Paralyzed Veterans of America. He can make months of red tape turn into a wait of just a few days. He's on call 24 hours a day. Newly injured patients are his priority. It's easy for veterans to get lost in the system, he says. You need an advocate. Now the Lathams are looking for housing in Omaha. With Joe Badzmarowski's help, they'll get assistance from the military, up to $50,000, to buy a new home or convert an existing home in order to make it accessible. Latham wants to start his own business selling collectibles and use some of the profits to help others.
Obviously, in a business, you can make a lot of money, which is a lot of money that you can donate to different charities.
Latham seems full of confidence, and he's worried about how he might react to a family all too eager to help him out when he gets to Omaha.
I've always considered myself kind of a strong person, so kind of worried about my family. I think I may get too much family at one time, and they may decide, well, he's paralyzed and he can't do anything or whatever, and there's a lot of things that I can do.
Before his injury, Latham used to carry a 3-ring binder about half an inch thick with him, his book of business ideas. He's looking forward to seeing it again.
Our visit to the Latham family at the West Roxbury Veterans Hospital was reported by Here Now's Fred Tice. Well, this news, the Pentagon is saying that an attack today at a U.S. base in Mosul has killed at least 20 people, including a reported 13 American soldiers. Rockets and mortar rounds hit the base's mess hall at lunchtime. A reporter embedded with a battalion stationed at the base said explosions knocked soldiers off their feet and out of their seats, and that a giant fireball enveloped the top of the mess hall tent. Brigadier General Carter Hamm, who is the commander of Task Force Olympia, one of the battalions stationed in Mosul, said that American soldiers, private contractors, and Iraqi forces are among the victims.
It's a sad day in Mosul, but as they always do, soldiers will come back from that and they will do what they can do best to honor those who are fallen today, and that is to see this very important mission through to a successful completion. That's what we owe you, the American people, and that's what we owe the people of Iraq, and that is exactly what we shall do.
A radical group called the Ansar al-Sunnah Army put a statement on the Internet claiming responsibility. Today's attack came on the same day that British Prime Minister Tony Blair made a surprise visit to Baghdad. Blair said the ongoing violence in Iraq is now a battle between democracy and terrorism. You're listening to Here and Now. Only four more shopping days till Christmas. How much money have you spent so far in gifts? Well, one author proposes spending no more than $100. Bill McKibben's book, $100 Holiday, is for sale. He joins us on the line from his home outside Middlebury, Vermont. Welcome, Bill.
Robin, it's good to be with you.
And first off, I have to say, you obviously, $100 for the whole holiday, you obviously don't know how much American Girl dolls cost. I'm sure people say to you, how do you do this?
We don't tell people to go out and collect their receipts and make sure they're right to the penny. The point is to give people a kind of figure to hold on to as a kind of anchor against the tide of commercialism at this season.
Tell us, what are some of the things you do?
Really what it's about is understanding that the most precious thing at the moment is time in our lives, not money and not stuff. Most of us have enough stuff. We don't have enough time with our family, with our neighbors, and not enough time certainly for just kind of quiet and reflection and being out in the natural world a little bit and things like that.
You could give a back rub, for instance, or you could go on a hike or bring cookies to neighbors.
Or, you know, we have a lot of, say, grandparents who want to give something to their grandchildren, and they go and find a kid's book that they read to their own children, their grandchildren's parents when they were young. They read the book into a tape, and they send the book along with the tape, and, you know, there they are, part of that grandchild's bedtime, for the next 3 months. Don't go to the store and buy a piece of jewelry for your daughter. Go into that, you know, drawer of jewelry you already have and find a piece that you wore to your prom. Give that to them and write a note to go with it telling about what you were like then and what that occasion was like. I guarantee you that's going to mean more than the, you know, 8 inches of gold chain from Zales or whatever.
Well, as you know, Bill, you have been accused of single-handedly destroying the economy. In the New Republic, Margaret Talbot posed the question, I would like to know what McKibben has to say about the jobs that would be lost, starting with minimum wage retail positions.
Yeah, it seems to me unlikely that capitalism depends on people celebrating the birth of someone who told us to give everything we have to the poor by awarding each other, you know, golf clubs and neckties and toaster ovens and things. I doubt that capitalism is that fragile. And if you're worried about that, an excellent thing to do is take the money that you were going to spend on Christmas and give it to people who are in real need of things, you know. Money spent at a soup kitchen buying the ingredients for soup for homeless people, of whom there were more this Christmas than ever before, goes into the economy just as surely and probably in better form than, you know, money spent buying yet another made-in-China video game or whatever it is.
Or just at the very least, maybe even just curtail your spending. I'm reading another statistic that the Center for a New American Dream found. 47% of Americans went into debt over the holidays. So there's that issue as well that this could cut into. But it does seem, Bill, to come back to kids.
In some ways, they're easier than adults to talk for this stuff about because they understand the concept of birthdays, you know. They know that on somebody else's birthday, you have a party and you know, it's a lot of fun, but you don't expect, you know, that the whole thing is about awarding you stuff. This is somebody else's birthday that we're celebrating here, and kids understand that. I think a good experiment to run with your child is to ask them what they remember about last Christmas and see if what they can do is list all the things they got or whether it's the things that are important to to them that they really remember are the kind of family rituals, the special things that happen.
Yeah.
If it's the latter, begin to de-emphasize the buying the stuff.
Bill McGibbon, before we let you go, just tick off a couple of things you've given to your child at Christmas.
I remember when she was very young, because I can see it hanging on the wall, on her second birthday or so, I made her a little tiny walking stick from some saplings out in the yard. Things like that that hang around forever are great fun for me.
Bill McGibbon, thank you so much. And
happy holidays, Robin.
Merry
Take
Christmas
care.
To you.
Bye.
Bill McGibbon, author of $100 Holiday. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Recently, customers crowded Wordsworth Books, a family-owned independent bookstore in Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The store is going to be closing in half an hour.
On this day, that usual announcement has a particular punch. After 28 years, many of them as one of the country's most successful independent bookstores, Wordsworth was closing its doors for good.
There is nothing, in fact, that is good about a store like this closing. I wish they could find a better market for themselves.
Longtime customers lean on near empty shelves, poring over books. Here's a student reading, yes, The Metrosexual, but also Reptiles and Amphibians, An Identification and Care Guide, Alexander Scriabin's Piano Concerto in F-sharp minor, and Destiny and Chance, Our Place in the Solar System.
I wouldn't have woken up this morning and said, I need a book about our solar system and its place in the cosmos. But it's the kind of place where you can show up and find it and be like, oh, how could I live without knowing what's in this book, you know?
Hi.
Oh, hi.
I've seen you for years here.
Right. I've worked here for 15 years. There's a bunch of people who are coming back just, you know, to watch the doors close and be in the store for the last few hours. It's been a very emotional time for all of us. I mean, this bookstore has been a real labor of love for many people. It's just incredibly sad. It's been a lot of tears shed. We've actually cried with our customers.
You know, and people hearing this who don't live here might say, but gosh, so much support, so much love for this store. How couldn't it stay open?
The internet has made a big difference. We had many people who loved us who would come in, but they really weren't willing to wait a few more days to get a book through a special order. Just it's interesting to me to see how small choices add up in a big way.
As customers stream through the store, Wordsworth's owners, Hillel Stavis and his wife Donna Friedman, try to explain what happened.
I think it was because of the Amazoning of America. Too many big box bookstores and changing reading habits. We weren't only competing with the internet, but we're competing with big screen TVs, lots of other things. Harvard Square has changed a lot, too. It has many fewer independent businesses.
People, I've been standing here, people have been crying.
Yeah, when an auto parts store, nobody comes in, when an auto parts store demises and says, I bought my windshield wipers here. Many people used to come in and say, well, I met my wife or my husband in the psychology aisle, or we broke up in the art aisle. You know, so it's, you know, it's amazing the number of people that come in and actually cry in your face. That's why it's difficult to take. Wordsworth isn't the only store that suffered this fate. There are famous stores all around the country that have suffered similar fates.
Well, it is very sad, I imagine, for most of the customers. But actually, the news is that there are fewer of these kind of closings the last few years.
That's John Mutter, executive editor for Bookselling for Publishers Weekly. He says that, in fact, independent bookstores have stabilized after dropping from 40% of the market in the 90s to just 17% today. John says that further closings have been prevented largely because of the efforts of the industry group, the American Booksellers Association.
It's helping a lot, and the main thing that they're doing is a program they call BookSense, where they offer websites to the members, because a lot of independent booksellers can't afford or don't have the time to put together their own websites. They also do gift cards. The people who buy the gift cards can send them to people across the country, and they can redeem them in independent booksellers.
What are independent bookstores doing to sell themselves?
Well, I think they're trying to be like a place to hang out. They'll do programs with community groups. They'll go out and sell books at events and seminars and those kind of things.
You've told us of one bookstore that was quite enterprising in Florida that actually sold their books at a furniture store.
Right. Books in Coral Gables and Miami Beach, they just opened a 1,000-square-foot shop in the factory outlet of Levender, which sells a lot of book-related furniture. So people can go in there, buy the furniture, and then buy books to put in the furniture.
Yeah. What is the one factor that a bookstore, if it wants to live, has to consider?
Well, I think they really have to specialize in the sense of have what the customers want. And I know that sounds really simple, but it's in this day and age, it's not the easiest thing. It used to be most independent bookstores had a nice little selection of titles of general interest. Because of chain bookstores, which simply have many thousands more titles, and because of the Internet, which has everything, those bookstores can't use that model anymore.
What are some of the specialty bookstores, independent bookstores, that are making it?
Well, the ones that are doing fairly well are mystery stores, science fiction stores. Religion bookstores are doing very well.
The owner of Wordsworth says one of the things he wanted to try to do was have a cafe, but his landlord wouldn't allow him to have food. How important is a cafe to a bookstore nowadays?
Nowadays, it's almost like it's not a bookstore. It's that important.
What does the industry talk about the closing of Wordsworth?
Well, I think it was always considered a really difficult market. I mean, Cambridge used to have a lot of bookstores, and most of them are gone now.
Now, this is a tragedy. I thought this institution would stay here forever.
Well, maybe Wordsworth could have stayed open if the owners had been able to serve food. But then there are other factors, the controversies. Hillel Stavis says people would threaten to boycott his store over books they didn't like. And some did boycott and picket after he withdrew advertising from public radio stations, including WBUR here in Boston, and certain newspapers, because of what he felt was biased coverage against Israel. Did that have an impact? Water under the bridge, he now says, as employees prepare to lock the doors for good.
But it's a sad day. I've been coming here for years, so it's sort of like leaving your house when you move out of a house.
What we just happened to be in the neighborhood today, and we came back to say goodbye to the store. I can't believe it's closing.
You really would come say goodbye to a store?
Well, yeah, this one's worth it. Got to support our local bookstores.
We're closed. No, nothing. Yeah, bye.
People are waving at you out there. Did you see that? People were, like, waving goodbye.
Yeah, I know. Oh, boy. I spent many nights doing this, but it's kind of funny to do it for the last time. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
We are closed.
Oh, what a sad day.
Yeah, it is. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for coming all these years. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for all the memories. Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye. Thank you for all your help. And enjoy your new venture.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Is that the last customer?
Bye.
Is it the crack of the pool ball? Neon buzzing. Telephone ringing.
Wordsworth Books closed its doors for good in October. The owners still own a children's bookstore. Curious George goes to Wordsworth, and that is thriving. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Thanks today to George Hex. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now. Thank you. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.